Hi, this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Oh my gosh, do you want to learn the biohacker secret to great sleep, great energy, great focus? You're going to hear from the legendary Ben Greenfield today. He's also going to show you how to be a great father and raise great children. My goodness, did he drop some knowledge. We basically got his 24-hour schedule and everything that he does with his family, their meditation principles, when he eats that frog in the morning. You're going to be surprised by this. You're going to hear about his cookbook. You're going to hear about when he goes to the bathroom. You're going to hear about his bedtime secrets. He's going to help people who are insomniacs, and he's going to help you have more focus. This is an amazing episode of Early to Rise Radio, and I don't want you to miss it. So let's jump into this conversation with Ben while he walks around his property in Washington State. That's right. It's a walk and talk with Craig Valentine here at Early to Rise Radio. Let's jump into it. Ben Greenfield, it's been a long time since we met in 2016 at Paleo Effects. How are you doing?
Geez, was it 2016?
I think so.
I'm good. I'm good. I've had a lot of time on the home front lately, and my son's just turned 13, and so I've been fostering them into adolescence and doing a lot of writing, and just spending a lot of time outdoors up here in Spokane, actually.
That's cool, man. And so, you know, you wrote a massive book that I have, you know, in my book files called Boundless, and you have a Boundless cookbook too.
Oh yeah. Actually the cookbook launches next week. Okay. It's super cool. Cause like I have gotten the cooking bug like the past 2 years, you know, cause it started off, I got into bow hunting. So I'd be coming home with like, you know, sheep and goat and turkey and wild pig and deer and, you know, all these different animals. And my wife didn't really have a background in wild game cooking. So I just had to start to figure out all these marinades and rubs and spices and grilling techniques. And then I kind of simultaneously got into like plant foraging, you know, for like nettle and mint and Oregon grape and all the stuff that grows around our house, and started using a lot of that in my recipes. And then I kind of like to geek out on technology. So then I got into like sous vide and smoking and pressure cooking and, you know, reverse sears and, you know, all these different crazy ways to prepare the food. And, you know, at the end of a couple of years, I was like, dude, I have so many cool ideas. I should just like write a cookbook with all these weird things I'm doing in the kitchen. So yeah, it's a ton of fun. Cause you know, I love to eat too. So that's a bonus.
That's fantastic, man. And you know, you're famous all over the world for this self-experimentation. Where did this desire come from? And when did you start biohacking? Like back in kindergarten or something?
Well, I mean, like, you know, I've always been hardwired as a kid, I've just been kind of voraciously curious, particularly when it comes to just like learning new things. You know, there's guys like, I suppose, you know, maybe like the Josh Waitzkins or the Tim Ferrisses of the world who are kind of well known for, you know, picking up some random hobby or tactic or book or goal and kind of rolling with it. And also maybe producing content along with it for other people who want to learn along the way. And I think I might be wired up a little bit similarly. Like, you know, I was homeschooled K through 12 and therefore did have a lot of kind of like free time to pursue, you know, other interests. And, you know, I tend to be one of those guys who like get interested in something and just like explore it inside and out for a really long time. And then not necessarily be married to that, like being part of my life forever. You know, like I did Ironman triathlon, for example, for like 10 years. And then one day I was just like, all right, done enough of that. And, you know, I don't think I'll be the 50-year-old, you know, swimming and biking and running all day. But that was like a chapter of my life. And I learned a lot about endurance and endurance physiology and endurance nutrition, and then, you know, moved on to other stuff. But as far as the biohacking piece goes, really, I would say like probably my first kind of elements of experimentation in terms of hacking human biology was like, just like back when I was a bodybuilder in college, you know, cause those are, some of the original biohackers, I suppose, if you're not counting the people who, you know, were like installing magnetic chips in their fingertips or, you know, injecting chlorophyll into their eyeballs, really like bodybuilders, everything from, you know, peptides to SARMs to hormones to injections to, you know, wrapping tourniquets around their limbs way before BFR training was popular. I mean, I would say that population probably falls into the category of being like a self-experimentation style of crowd, particularly when it comes to human biology. And so, yeah, in college, I did bodybuilding for a couple of years and just kind of got bit by the bug of figuring out ways that one could enhance your biology beyond just like basic fitness and nutrition principles, even though I was fully natural and I didn't have enough money to afford any of the, you know, the fancy stuff that could accelerate results. I was more like, you know, macro ratios and, you know, and tourniquet training and trying out different types of stacks and body part splits and things like that. But then after that, I got an Ironman triathlon, which is kind of a sport of attrition, right? Meaning that if you don't really have like the nutrition and hydration piece and even like, you know, body temperature piece and all that kind of dialed in, you're at a disadvantage. And so, you know, I got into like, you know, looking into heat training, cold training, different recovery tactics, you know, compression and hyperbaric and, you know, just like all the things that a lot of athletes don't really think about. And between that and bodybuilding, like those are probably the first two sports that really got me interested in, okay, so what can we do to accelerate human results that go beyond just the basics of what we know about, say, you know, nutrition or proper training?
Yeah, that's pretty darn amazing. And so one of the questions, like, I'm sure people listening to this are going, whoa, this is like way too intense for me. Oh my goodness. Well, what if we switch it around and say, what do you think are some of the things that people are doing, you know, in the quote unquote biohacking stuff that actually is kind of a waste of time? Like, are a lot of people spending a lot of time on something that you've discovered to actually not be that beneficial?
Well, I mean, there's like a few avenues of thought, right? There's the people who are like biohacking for longevity, you know, so that they can live 150 years or whatever, but they're spending like, you know, 40 of those years cold and hungry and libidoless and huddled up inside of some kind of a cryotherapy chamber, or hyperbaric chamber, cut off from their friends because, you know, you got to live a long time, bro. And, you know, I think that's one aspect of just, you know, like an unhealthy obsession. And then I think that, I would say that when it comes to a lot of like protocols that are popular in biohacking, like, you know, hyperbaric chambers or cryotherapy or like, you know, red light beds or a lot of these things that popular biohackers these days are doing. It's like, honestly, a lot of that stuff was developed for, you know, NASA astronauts to recover from days in space, or professional athletes who are doing like two a days, you know, and pretty hefty two a days. And like, there are some biohackers, like many, you know, who are walking for 30 minutes on a treadmill and then engaging in like 2 hours of advanced recovery protocols designed for, again, like professional athletes or people whose careers completely destroy their bodies. And I think sometimes people just like overdo it, hearing that something's really good, but not realizing, yeah, that whatever that, you know, the hyperbaric treatment or, you know, or whatever that seems to work well in someone who's like post TBI or concussion or who has rampant muscle inflammation or rhabdo isn't really going to be the best use of your time if you're just like going for a walk in the sunshine every morning. So I think sometimes just like, you know, some hackers would probably see better results if they were perhaps even exercising a little bit better or more and spending a little bit less time just sitting around trying to figure out how to zap their bodies. So yeah, I see some of that. And then the other thing also is like, I also see the emergence of a lot of these technologies that simulate what nature could do for you, right? So people are sleeping all night on pulsed electromagnetic field mats or standing at their office all day and grounding or earthing mats, but not really ever going outside barefoot. Or they've like got these like $3,000 infrared light panels in their office and they can get out in the sun, but they just kind of like don't go for a sunshine walk at lunch because they can stay inside on their computer, you know, reading some Reddit forum on biohacking while they're standing under red light, you know, and then, you know, like, I guess, you know, another example would be like cold, right? Like, you know, spending $70 to go stand for 3 minutes in a cryotherapy chamber when there's like, you know, an icy cold river a mile from your house you could go jump into, but it doesn't look as sexy on Instagram, you know? So I think that there are some elements of biohacking that get a little bit silly, like some of the examples that I just gave, but I personally try to strike a balance between, you know, natural living and also the smart use of technology to recover faster or get better exercise results, or, you know, even decrease the rate of aging to a certain extent, with, you know, time spent with family, time spent in nature, you know, time spent being productive and impactful and creating shit. And so, yeah, I certainly think it can become an unhealthy or excessively time consuming habit for a lot of people.
Yeah. So right now you're outside walking in nature. You know, break us down. Like, are you literally just walking in nature wearing a pair of shoes that normal, quote unquote normal person would wear? And then,
no.
And then what?
I've got an astronaut suit on. I've got a laser light probe up my anus, so I'm kind of walking a little cockeyed here. I've got a little 10-acre, you know, plot out here in Washington State where we, you know, we raise goats and chickens, and we're building out some mushroom logs right now, and a little pond where we're going to add some ducks and grow most of our food here. And, you know, I also hunt out here in the forest, you know, sometimes for a whitetail, but, I'm walking right now on this little trail that I built around the property that I used to use. So I raced for about 4 years professionally in obstacle course racing. And so during that time, whenever I'd encounter an obstacle to race that I couldn't really conquer, I'd try and recreate it and build it at home. So I essentially have this giant track that loops around my house. It's about a quarter mile long. It's got like ropes hanging from the trees, you know, and climbing logs and balance beams and, you know, crazy monkey bar setups. And I used to train on it a lot more when I was doing Spartan racing, but now a lot of times, you know, I'll hop on a call with a guy like you and just kind of, you know, walk loops around the course and get some sunshine, some fresh air, or go up on some farm roads back behind my house. And let's see, am I biohacked at all? I suppose. Yeah, I've got one thing. Well, probably two things going on. These would be examples of biohacks. I might fall in that category. I'm wearing my regular, just like my Brooks shoes. And sometimes I'll wear minimalist shoes. Sometimes I'll wear shoes with a little more padding or cushioning if my feet are just beat up from a previous day's training session or something. But I've got, I was talking about grounding or earthing, how like when your skin is in contact with the planet, you actually absorb a lot of negative ions. There appears to be, and there's a pretty compelling body of research behind the anti-inflammatory effects of it's about a 10 to 100 hertz frequency that the earth naturally emits. That's why going outside barefoot or going on a walk on the beach or even just like laying in your backyard with your shirt off or something like that, it's actually pretty good for you. And the problem is, of course, shoes are not conductive. Most, you know, rubber soles don't conduct those negative ions or that electrical field. But I've got these straps on the bottom of my Brooks. They're called Earthy. I think it's spelled E-R-T-H-E. And I saw Djokovic playing in a tennis match. He had these straps on and he was actually, he was wearing them on court during a match to stay grounded or earthed during his match. And so I don't think I got them on Amazon. I forget where I got them, but I got a pair and put them in a couple of my shoes. So I've got that going on. I guess I'm like grounded or earthed as I'm walking, even though I'm wearing shoes. So I don't, you know, step on a thorn or something. And then I've been kind of into skin health lately. And I was researching different types of, they're called bioregulators, like things that could increase hair growth or improve firmness or elasticity of the skin or decrease wrinkles, particularly when applied to the skin and then exposed to infrared light, like you would get from sunlight, which I'm walking under, for example. So I've been using this skin cream. It's a combination of two different molecules. One's called GHK copper peptide, which is actually also used in kind of like functional medicine and the athletic sector as like an injectable peptide for recovery or for joints. We can also apply it topically, like it's a small enough size where it gets absorbed transdermally. So I've got like that, you know, that's just what I use as a lotion. I put some of it on my face and my hair along with this other interesting molecule that traditionally it's been used orally as like a really good natural anti-inflammatory or a like a longevity enhancing agent. It's called C60 or carbon 60. It's also known as Buckminster fullerene, and you can also apply it topically. And so, yeah, I've got C60 and GHK copper peptides, like a topical lotion on my skin, just because if I'm walking in the sunlight anyways, why not, you know, kind of work on skin and hair health while I'm doing it. And then I'm grounded / earthed as I'm walking. But I don't have laser lights up my butt. No.
Okay. Well, you know, you can always add the probe later, I suppose, when you get home. So how long do you expect to live? Like what are your ambitions or realistic predictions? Like, do you think Ben lives to 105? Does he go for 150? Does he check?
Well, forest for the trees. I don't really care that much. I mean, my goal is to maintain health span and lifespan simultaneously and just make maximum impact with however many years I'm kind of like genetically programmed, you know, plus in combination with healthy living, kind of going to live. And so for me, it's about the functionality and the mental and physical acuity I can maintain no matter how many years I'm alive. And so, you know, I think that's important that your goal be more, you know, how many people can you love and impact during the years that you do have than, you know, how long are you going to live? But if you look at epidemiological data and, you know, where we're at right now, not what people are spitballing about, but where we're actually at, you know, and the rate of decline of maximum human lifespan, it appears for the most part for like the past 30 years, we've kind of topped off somewhere between about 112 and 120. Right? And that hasn't been increasing noticeably, even with technologies and medicine and hygiene or anything else. And so I personally don't see anything compelling enough to demonstrate that it's going to be a lot longer than that, that most people live. There are guys like Ray Kurzweil or, you know, Peter Diamandis who say, you know, the first person to live to 150 in modern era is already walking around the face of this planet, you know, and they're basing that, I suppose, based on a lot of those biohacks I was talking about. Like maybe that person is, you know, taking NAD and getting stem cell infusions and using a hyperbaric chamber and a cryotherapy chamber and, you know, and engaging in things like, you know, fasting protocols and, you know, all these things that when stacked together may have an impact on, you know, rate of telomere shortening or inflammation, et cetera. But none of that has yet been proven out. And again, like until I see long-term human research, you know, even if it's epidemiological, that shows, oh, hey, we're now living on average, you know, for our super centenarians to 100 and, you know, whatever, 16 and a half instead of 115, you know, I really can't say that I would expect to live any longer than 120. And that would be like in my wildest dreams at this point, based on any of the research I've seen.
Fascinating, man. Fascinating. What are your kids like? You have kids or just the one son?
I've got twin sons.
Okay, at 13.
Yeah, they're 13. And I actually, it's kind of weird for me because I used to say my twin boys, and I've kind of tried to eliminate that from my vernacular of late because, you know, I think that particularly for young men, that we've kind of lost with a lot of indigenous cultures and, you know, older hunter-gatherer tribes and, you know, many non-westernized cultures have had, which is almost like that recognized ceremonial rite of passage into adolescence or even a rite of passage later on into adulthood, you know, that recognizes a young man as a contributing member of society who can protect and provide, who isn't walking around like wondering, hey, am I a man yet? You know, when am I not a boy? You know, you see a lot of men walking around in men's bodies with, you know, with boys' emotions and boys' psychology, you know, doing things like, you know, knocking up women and walking away because they don't have the responsibility to protect and provide as a father, you know, and take responsibility for a baby that they've helped produce, you know, which of course contributes to things like fatherlessness or abortion. You see, you know, men making irresponsible choices, you know, whether it be socially or with the type of impact they decide to have with the life they've been given or the purpose statement they form for themselves, because they've never really been fostered through passage into adulthood. You know, women to a certain extent experience that, but women do have, you know, like a recognized biological point at which they become, they're a woman, right? They start their period the recognition that, that biologically they become women. And arguably, when a woman has her first child, right, that's also almost like a rite of passage. It's like, oh, hey, you are, you know, you're becoming a matriarch, right? You're a, you know, contributing member of society to a certain extent in a very, very deep sense of the word. But men, I think I have less of that. And so I've been really careful to weave that into my own son's upbringing. And so, like, you know, last month they, you know, they prepared for like 6 years with wilderness survival classes and all sorts of things leading up to last month, where they had a, you know, they had a 5-day rite of passage in the wilderness with a backpack and a wool blanket and a knife. And, you know, and it was hard for them. It was dark and it was scary and it was lonely and they weren't with their twin brother. And, you know, and I had to kind of cut the cord, so to speak, of, as a parent and trust that they'd be okay. But, you know, they came out of that. We had a very ceremonial, you know, like a fire gathering and songs and, you know, recognition of their passage into adolescence. And then later on this summer, they're doing a kind of like a giant party for all their, you know, family, grandparents, cousins, nephews, et cetera, where they host, you know, a giant dinner and have everybody over and they give a speech, you know, about becoming a man. And, you know, and there will be no doubt in my boys' minds, like, yeah, this is when I became, you know, when I started my transition into adulthood, and this is when I became a man. This is when I became a contributing member of my parents' household. This is when I learned to protect. This is when I learned to provide. And so that's something that's been kind of like the theme for me for the past several months in my boys' lives. And they are, they're unschooled, meaning that we school them basically not through books or formal curriculum, but they just kind of learn through life experiences. Like, you know, their math curriculum last year was building a tree fort out in the woods, you know, and learning angles and geometry and, you know, wood cutting skills and things like that as well. And, you know, their chemistry is that they have a cooking podcast, right? And so they're doing all sorts of molecular gastronomy and combining, you know, salt and sugar and acid and heat and, you know, making souffles or, you know, or sometimes they're, you know, whatever, making miniature volcanoes out in the front yard. I allow them to have, not allow them to have, but encourage them to have a lot of creative free play where, you know, they just go out and find the things they're passionate about. And I try to support them with books or games or activities or trips that help to support that. You know, anytime we go on a trip as a family, we don't just leave to go on the trip. We learn the language. We learn to cook some of the meals. We learn the cultural mannerisms. We study up on the archaeology or the architecture in the area that we're going to. And so, you know, we like to use travel as schooling, but we're really, really big on education being based around this combination of creative free play and then just experiential learning. So that's kind of what we do with them. And I mean, like they're not little truants yet. They're not in prison. I think they're turning into fine young men thus far, but you know how it is as a parent, you know, in many cases you are learning as you go. You're staying one step ahead of your kids and hoping they don't know that.
That's amazing, man. I think you and Bedros Koulian would get along with that because he took his son to Utah, and you know they did a, he had a bunch of men there and they all shared their life experiences with his son. And you know, when he turned 13, that was a couple years ago, and it, you know, he wanted to have a similar, you know, it was similar but not similar to your son's rite of passage where there was wisdom passed down from the elders, sort of thing. And so I think that he's going to love when I share this with him. Now I'm just going to switch gears a little bit. You know, you have your twin sons, you have, you know, you're busy. You got your cooking, you got all the books and stuff. Now at Early to Rise, which is a business I run, we are big fans of morning routines. Walk us through yours, please.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of morning routines as well. And evening routines. But so my morning routine, typically I wake up around 4:30 or 5 and don't wake to an alarm clock. I'll just kind of naturally wake. And usually I get out of bed, and from a health standpoint, I weave a lot of principles of Ayurvedic medicine into my own personal self-care routine. Meaning I'll do things like tongue scraping and coconut oil pulling and gargling with essential oils, you know, like garlic or peppermint or oregano. And really like some of the Ayurvedic principles in terms of that morning routine. And then, you know, I'll do all that and come out of the bathroom and go downstairs and usually put on a little bit of hot water for some coffee or for tea. And I rotate. Sometimes I'll do like mushroom tea. Sometimes I'll do coffee. Sometimes I'll do, you know, Tulsi tea or green tea. I'm a little bit kind of woo on that, like a little bit intuitive. Like I'll wake up in the morning and kind of go into the pantry and just, you know, take a deep breath in and survey the different coffees and teas and mushroom extracts and be like, okay, what's my body kind of wanting this morning? And then, you know, I'll prepare that. And typically as the hot water's going or the coffee is steeping in the French press or whatever, I do about 10 to 15 minutes of mobility training, you know, and that's, you know, everything from foam rolling to lacrosse balls to dynamic stretching to, you know, I kind of live my life such that I'm pretty physically active throughout the day, you know, like walking like I am right now with you, or, you know, stopping to swing kettlebells or, you know, hang from a pull-up bar here and there. So I kind of like treat my morning as almost just like a warm-up for working out and moving the rest of the day. Plus I figure, you know, by the time the end of the week rolls around, you know, I've amassed a good like 75 to 90 minutes of deep tissue work by just doing it all, you know, right there in the morning while the coffee and stuff is going. And so, you know, I usually am doing a combination of some of those Ayurvedic, you know, cleansing and health techniques and kind of oral care techniques, and then like some mobility and some deep tissue work. And then, after I've done the mobility and the deep tissue and everything, and the coffee's ready, I'll go into my office, and I actually do have some of those red light panels I was talking about. Uh-huh. So I flip all those on. I use a lot of light therapy in the morning, so I have those on, but then I also typically will wear like glasses that produce blue light or some like sunlight simulator in my office. And although in many cases I'm doing that stretching or foam rolling like out in the sunshine, especially in the spring or the summer, I kind of like harness a whole bunch of different photonic light devices in my office and just blast my body with light and really get my circadian rhythm going in the morning. And usually for those first 20 minutes or so while I'm, you know, drinking some coffee or whatever, I'm just kind of easing myself into the day. I like to read some research articles. You know, I don't jump right in and eat the frog as the very first thing, like jump straight into like the hardest article I got to write for the day or the biggest task, just because I find I can kind of turn on the brain a little more slowly just by going through some research and stuff. And then I finish up all that. I finished up the coffee and stuff by then. And then right after that, that's when I'll, you know, I used to like read first thing when I woke up, like devotionally or scripturally or like some spiritual reading, you know, including, you know, Bible, time with God, stuff like that. And I actually found it to be more meaningful for me after I'd done some of those other things to almost like wake my brain up. So then after I've done like the research and the coffee and everything, usually by then it's around, you know, around 6 a.m. or so. And that's when I'll take a little break and go read the Bible and pray and do a little bit of breath work and kind of like a miniature meditation session, not too long. I mean, we're talking like, you know, 2 to 4 minutes, just closing the eyes, getting in touch with the body. At that point, then I feel a little bit more primed for the day. So then usually it's about 6:30 or so. And then I'll spend about the next hour doing the deep work, right? Like the article I got to really make a dent in for the day or whatever, you know, whatever kind of seems to be that one thing that's going to take a lot of cognitive willpower or might be harder to do with decision-making fatigue later on in the day. And so I usually wrap that up around 7:30 and I've made a pretty good dent, you know, whatever that is, because I can get some decent riding done over the course of an hour, you know, once that coffee surges through my veins and I'm charged up and everything. And then by then the kids and wife are up, and that's when we do our main meditation for the morning. So I gather the family, we all have journals. I actually developed my own journal specifically for this. It's called the Spiritual Disciplines Journal. And we all sit down and we close our eyes and begin about a 6 count in, 6 count out. And I use an app called Insight Timer that'll chime at various intervals. And so those first 2 minutes are just getting in touch with the body, connecting with God, connecting with self. And then when the chime goes off, the next 2 minutes, continue with that breath work, is all gratitude. So the journal has a prompt to write down what it is you're grateful for. We really visualize what it is we're grateful for, bring it to life, breathe it into our heart center, really, really try and like relive whatever it is that we were grateful for that morning or from the previous evening. And really focus on gratitude for 2 minutes. And then the chime goes off again on a little timer that I use. And then we shift to service, where you think of one person who you can go out of your way to pray for or help or serve on that day. and you spend the next couple of minutes as you're meditating and breathing, just planning that out. Sometimes even right then and there, beginning to pray for or send positive emotions to that person. And so you do that for about 2 minutes. And the final chime goes off. When the final chime goes off, when you're in kind of that deep meditative space and super relaxed, we all set an anchor. So typically for me, it's tapping on my heart. For one of my sons, he taps on his wrist, but we all set that physical anchor so that later on in the day, if we're stressed or we need to return to that feeling of peace or calm, we can tap that same anchor and kind of return to that same place psychologically. And I actually find that to be really helpful. And then we all finish by praying together and do a big group family hug, meet for about 5 minutes to make sure everybody's kind of on the same page for whatever's going on that day. And then we all part ways. I'll typically duck into the restroom and have my morning poo after that. And then usually around then it's like 8:15. And so between about 8 and 9, I'll do like a sauna session or like a sauna cold pool session or a walk in the sunshine or a little workout, you know, a little movement session, typically for about 30 or 40 minutes. Finish that up and make myself a little smoothie, you know, usually like some bone broth, some ice. I kind of go like, you know, kind of lower calorie for breakfast, usually after I've fasted about 12 to 16 hours. So I'm breakfast around 9:30. And it's, you know, kind of light, but usually it's like a smoothie or something or some bone broth. Cause I'll have a bigger lunch and even bigger dinner. And then between about, you know, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., it's all work, you know, podcasts and articles and interviews and, you know, just everything for about the next 4 hours. You know, there's a lot of deep work time, mostly productive work time. And then I'll break for lunch, usually around 2, and have a nice salad, you know, some fish or nuts. So kind of like a Mediterranean style salad for lunch with usually a big cup of bone broth after that. And then I always take a nap, you know, because I only sleep about maybe six and a half hours in the evening. Mm-hmm. But then I always get a nap in the afternoon for about 20 to 45 minutes or so after lunch. And I find that's super sustainable for me. And I like it better than trying to do 8 to 9 hours a night, but not getting that really productive early morning time in. Yeah. And so I'll do a little nap. And then after my nap, I get up and that's when I do all my reactive work for the day. Like all the emails, all the last minute phone calls, all the people, you know, busting down your door for this or that. I don't do that stuff in the morning. Like I find morning is all productive, deep work. Afternoon is all like reactive work. And so, you know, from the time I get up from my nap, which is about, you know, 2:30 or 3 up until 5:30 or 6, I'm just working on all that. And then around like 6:30 or so, I'll take a break for either, you know, playing some tennis with the family or doing something active. Sometimes I'll go on another walk. Sometimes if I hadn't done like a weight training session that morning, I'll do a like, you know, weight training session kind of in the early evening instead. And then we typically all gather as a family about 7:30 or so for dinner. And we have these big, glorious family. Like we have dinner for like an hour, hour and a half together. We play games. We'll play like ping pong, cornhole, sometimes tennis before dinner. You know, we have like a closet full, like 60 games, you know, based on whatever rhetoric, logic, math, you know, everything from Scrabble to Boggle to Monopoly to silly card games. And we just play games every night as a family. And then we honestly don't even finish up dinner until like 9 or so, just because we're having such an awesome time every evening. And then we all go into my boys' room and I play them a song. I read them a story and we finish with the final meditation using that same book. And the final meditation is just self-examination. We all close our eyes for about 4 minutes and just play our day like a movie in our mind from start to finish, like watching ourselves in the third person. Go throughout our entire day. So we analyze our whole day with our eyes closed as we're breathing. And the journal has 3 prompts as you're watching that person, you know, that's you as like the character in the movie in the evening. It's the very last thing you do before you go to bed. And that is, what good have I done this day? What could I have done better on this day? And where was I most connected to my life's purpose on this day? So as you're watching that character in the movie of your mind, you're kind of like assessing, okay, when was I most proud of this person and rooting for them? And they were doing a really good job. It's like, what good did I do that day? And then where'd that person fail or learn from a mistake? Or where am I not proud of that person? Or where did I feel like they were more the villain than the hero? And then you write down that. So you learn from that and adjust the next day to make it even better. And then identify that one part where you were just like smiling in the zone, super connected to whatever unique skill set you've been given in life, just hyper connected to your life's purpose. and you write down, you know, what, at what point that was as well, just so that you're, you know, staying really connected and impactful in terms of your life's purpose every day. And then kiss the boys goodnight and finish off with a final prayer. And then, you know, my wife and I will go in the bedroom. Sometimes I'll read, sometimes we'll make love, you know, just usually I'm in the bedroom and asleep by around, you know, 10 PM or so. And then, you know, get up around 4:30 the next morning and start again.
Well, it's a beautiful day, my man, beautiful day. What have you tried that you have cast aside? Like earlier you mentioned, you don't eat the frog first thing in the morning. What else have you tried in your morning specifically that you, Ben, was just like, nah, this might work for others, but this, you know, kind of common thing is not for me.
Really hard workouts. I find that, and again, physiologically, because your body temperature peaks, your testosterone has a second peak, your reaction time peaks, your grip strength peaks. You know, that's usually between like 4:30 and like around 6:30 PM later on in the day. Plus, you know, by working out hard later on in the day, if you, as I do, kind of like have your largest meal of the day as dinner, you're kind of priming the glucose pumps and increasing your insulin sensitivity for like a big evening, you know, refeed, so to speak. So, you know, I like to save the harder workout if I have the luxury of time of being able to do that for later on in the day. And if I can choose on a day and it's not looking like I'm just going to be crushed mentally by the end of the day in terms of whatever my day's workload is, in the morning, I like to ease myself into the day and my, you know, quote, workout, unquote. It's more like a walk in the sunshine or a sauna session with a little bit of cold pool or a yoga session or something a little bit more deep and restorative, you know, versus the kick I was on for years where it's like you get up and just like, you know, go crucify yourself. So you're crawling out of the gym by 7 a.m. And I find the easy, more restorative workouts in the morning. That's one thing that's really stuck with me versus what I used to do, which was, you know, just beat myself up in the morning. And, you know, you're not only more stressed out, but you engage in more caloric hypercompensation, you know, the rest of the day. I find it works better to go easy in the morning. So that'd be one thing. Another would be, like I mentioned, like instead of meditation and breath work and devotional time and everything, like right when you get up, I find I like to actually have the brain a little bit more wet. I like to have the caffeine already surging in the system by that point. I like to have already kind of primed the brain with some easy reading or going through some research articles or blog posts. And so, yeah, you know, despite some people saying, you know, do the meditation, the breath work and the devotional time, you know, first thing, I actually kind of like the brain to be a little bit more warmed up before I do that. So that'd be a second thing that stuck. And then, you know, the idea of, you know, and this is something that I hope this isn't boring for people, but, you know, the whole idea of breakfast being the most important meal of the day. I just used to really crush huge breakfasts, you know, because I'd feel like I really had to top off the energy source for the day and just shifting to more light breakfast, a lot of intermittent fasting. And I always eat something in the morning, you know, 9 times out of 10. But, you know, I find like, you know, just like bone broth or really like light smoothie or something like that winds up resulting in a more productive morning for me, probably because, you know, less blood flow to the gut, less of that post-breakfast comatose feeling. And you know, again, I find that as long as I'm, you know, because I'm still pretty physically active, but as long as I'm really nailing a super nutrient dense dinner, and again, because we cook these amazing dinners as a family together anyways, like I get by in a pretty skimpy breakfast.
Beautiful. So one of my clients, I have two client questions before we wrap up here, Ben, which is one of them is a big fan of yours, a very successful entrepreneur over in Holland. And he's like, he's like, I can really crush a 35 or 40 minute focus time, but around then it wanes. And you mentioned that you had that, you know, you can really get a lot done in 60 minutes and I feel that way too. And his question was, what's the best way to keep and extend focus? What have you found?
You mean for physical workout?
For mental work.
Okay. I mean, I won't lie. Like I'm not opposed to the use of nootropics or smart drugs or even microdosing with psychedelics for focus. And that is something, you know, like I mentioned, I'll have some morning coffee or some morning cacao tea or a little bit of green tea or something like that. But that's usually not all I'll do. Like I'll use, you know, obviously as being an influencer in the nutrition industry, a lot of times I'm getting like bottles of different things that are, you know, like the Alpha Brains and the Siltep and the Qualias of the world, you know, all these different nootropic formula sent to my house. And, you know, and many of those actually work really well for, you know, giving you kind of like what you might be looking for in a cup of coffee, but more of that focused long-term energy without jitteriness. You know, like one example of, I think, a well-formulated one is just one, like I mentioned, called Qualia. And I'll use the caffeine-free version of that sometimes. Microdosing with LSD or microdosing with psilocybin, both of those can be really, really great mental performance aids that I think allow for not only merging of creativity and productivity, but a lot more focus productivity for a long time. And so, you know, I'm not opposed to the use of those. And then, you know, whereas nootropics would be considered more natural things, such as you might find in Qualia, or such as things like, you know, Ginkgo biloba or Gotu Kola or yerba mate, you know, or many of these like herbal formulations, smart drugs would be things like, you know, like modafinil or any of these so-called racetams, like piracetam or aniracetam. And there's a whole section in my book about kind of like stacking different nootropics or smart drugs or psychedelics. But I think that, you know, a little bit of better living through science, honestly, like I found that to be very, very helpful. And then, you know, yet even for me, I really don't go longer than about 35, like those 4 hours of deep work time I was talking about that I'll do between like 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's like, you know, 25 on, 5 off times 8, you know? And so I'm still stepping away like every 25 minutes. And that's to, you know, go swing some kettlebells or do a few quick stretches, or honestly, I even have like one of those cold tubs outside my office door that I keep at about 32 degrees. And sometimes like, you know, 25 minutes, go jump in that for a minute, towel off and come back. I mean, wow. You know, stuff like that, that just kind of breaks it up as you go. You know, that's kind of how I skin that cat. And then of course, for the focus piece, like all notifications off, you know, phones off, push notifications off, you know, except for I've got one app I have called Voxer. It's like a walkie talkie. And I keep that one on, and I have all notifications for everyone turned off, except like my CEO, my business manager, like the super important people who, if I'm engaged in deep work and they try and ping me, like those are the only people that I hear from that would distract me from that deep work, because I know that they might be asking me something that's like super time sensitive or crucial.
Got it. Perfect. Perfect. Now I have another client. She's a woman of about late 30s, early 40s. She's a little perimenopause, hormones are a little messed up, and she's insomniac. And, you know, it doesn't sound like you have a problem falling into a deep, restful sleep. First, can you give some general tips for people that struggle with sleep overall? And then second, people that have a little more serious insomnia, she's had a lot of insomnia. What would you say to people who are looking to have sleep better?
Yeah, I mean, basic sleep hygiene principles most people have heard. I don't want to insult people's intelligence, but, you know, again, it's like tons of really great natural light early in the day, and then just like totally cutting off blue light wherever the sun happens to set later in the day, in whatever part of the world you happen to be in. And that includes like installing like screen light blocking software on your devices. That includes wearing blue light blocking glasses. That includes, you know, like I've done, I replaced all the bulbs in the bedroom and the master bathroom with red bulbs instead of blue light producing bulbs or LED or fluorescent, you know, harsh lamps. So light is a big one. Cold is a big one. You know, I keep the temperature in the room for sleeping about 62 to 64 degrees. If I've done a workout or had a heavy meal before bed, it's always a cold shower or a walk outside in brisk cold weather if it's fall or winter. Like I like my body to be not quite shivering, but pretty cold when I crawl under the covers. And that helps quite a bit too. I even have one of those things called a chili pad that circulates cold water under the bed. There's another company that's interesting. If you find it's racing thoughts that keep you awake, that it's called an Ebb, and it kind of does the same thing, but circulates cold water on your forehead, kind of shifts some blood flow away from the frontal cortex and can dispel some of those racing thoughts. But yeah, cold is another big one. And then silence, or at least covering up a lot of ambient noise, especially if you live in an area where traffic might get loud at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, or, you know, sirens, dogs, et cetera. The one form of noise that seems to be the best for covering up ambient noise is called pink noise. You know, it's like white noise, brown noise, all these apps that make different kinds of noise that you could play, preferably with your phone in airplane mode, you know, at your bedside. But there's one app I like called Sleepstream that has pink noise. So I'll sometimes play that to cover up sounds that might keep me awake. And I often put in earplugs too, which help with that. That's especially when I travel. you know, to cover up noise. So sound would be another one, in addition to temperature and light. And then safety. Like, your body has to associate the bed not with business or work or stress, but with safety. So even if I'm at a hotel room, you know, I used to just like put my laptop on the bed and, you know, slap down there in my belly and lay on my belly and reply to emails on the bed. And so I get in bed at night and my body or brain would already associate the bed with a place where I do work. You know, now my computer doesn't come anywhere near the bedroom. There's no TV in the bedroom. There's no business books by the bedside, right? They're all like fiction or fun reading. And so when my body gets into bed, it's just programmed not to be thinking about work or thinking about business, and programmed for that to be a place of safety. Many people also find that sleeping with a gravity blanket, like those 15 to 25 pound, those seem to help a lot of people who struggle with feeling as though they're kind of in this safe, trusting nest when they're in bed. It seems to actually really help. It seems like a weird little hack, but gravity blankets help a lot of people who lay awake at night due to worrying. Now, in many cases, worrying causes a flood of excitatory neurotransmitters. And so there are certain elements, like from the plant kingdom, that can increase the production of inhibitory neurotransmitters, like lemon balm or valerian or chamomile. And there's one company called Quicksilver Scientific that makes a really good one, I think, called LipoCalm. And I recommend people who wake up at night with racing thoughts, who have racing thoughts to keep them awake at night, consider not only that forehead cooling device I talked about, but also the use of one of these inhibitory neurotransmitter precursors that can offset a lot of the excitatory neurotransmitters produced by evening rumination. And then in particular, for this woman who's perimenopausal, you know, whenever I'm working with a client, I always get, you know, everything from gut data, because believe it or not, like, you know, parasites, yeast, fungus, all that can interfere with sleep. I always get hormone data, typically via like a really good urinary hormone test. I always get blood data, you know, just to see, you know, anything from magnesium to vitamin D to lipids to all these other parameters, including inflammation, are at, which can also, you know, kind of impact those levels. And then usually even like genetic data, you know, to see what someone's built-in genetically required sleep mechanisms are, what type of things that might keep them from getting good sleep genetically are. And in the case of perimenopausal women, one thing she may want to look into is there is some evidence that the drop in progesterone that occurs around that time can impact not just, you know, things like hormone function and libido and general energy levels, but also sleep in women. And some women really, really feel quite good, especially in terms of offsetting some of the cortisol that can tend to become imbalanced when progesterone dips, with keeping a little bottle of a transdermal progesterone cream next to the bed. And if you want to wrap your head around this, I think it's Dr. Michael Platt, P-L-A-T-T, who has a book called, I think it's called The Adrenal Fix. And he talks about the use of progesterone for such uses. Interesting, he also likes it for kids with ADD and ADHD. But yeah, you know, you be careful. It is kind of a hormone, but yeah, a little bit of transdermal progesterone, like about a 3% progesterone cream for women and perimenopausal or postmenopausal, that they can keep next to the bedside at night. You know, my wife has a little bit of that. She's got a little bit of transdermal magnesium, which is a really good relaxant. And so she'll apply that to a hairless area of the body, like the neck or the inner arms, or the inner thighs before bed. And that can help a lot of women and men, the magnesium, but then the progesterone, particularly for women, can be helpful.
That's amazing, man. Wow. You're just a fountain of knowledge, and I really appreciate it, Ben. This has really been fantastic. Can you just put your camera on for a second, wave to everybody just to prove I was actually talking to Ben Greenfield?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I'll turn it on because this is funny. Okay. So I'm walking up my driveway right now, and this kid's walking in front of me. Hey, brother, turn around, show people what you're doing. I get my sons, I should say, workouts every day. What are you doing? He's carrying a 60-pound sandbag up the driveway. What's your workout this morning?
60-pound sandbag up the driveway. And then 30 mountain climbers.
30 mountain climbers at the top of the driveway? Three rounds. Nice shoes. All the way down to the bottom of the driveway and up. With nice. My 60-pound sandbag, 30 mountain climbers at the top. You do three rounds? Good job, brother.
That's amazing.
I always give them something physical to do in the morning. Yeah,
that's really good.
Got to make your kids harder to kill.
I love it, Ben. I really, really appreciate it, my man. I hope it's not another 5 years until we catch up again. And congratulations on your success. And this has been really, really helpful. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Hey, thanks everybody for tuning in. And thank you, Craig. It's good to see you, man.
All right. We'll talk to you soon, brother.
All right. Later, bro.
All right. That was a killer episode. That was unbelievable. You should see his book, Boundless. It is about 2 inches thick, but you know, it's got sections on everything. And so I encourage you to get his book, get his cookbook when it comes out. Go and check out Ben Greenfield online and let me know what you thought of today's show. Head over to iTunes, give us a 17-star rating for today's show. And then also drop me a message on Instagram at RealCraigValentine or email us at support@earlyrise.com. This was a pretty classic episode. Could have talked to that guy all day. But there's a couple of changes I'm going to go and make, and I can't wait to hear about the changes you're going to make too. So drop me a note and we'll talk to you soon.